Now we go to the area of antagonist drugs. We've been talking about agonists. Now I want you to look at antagonists. We'll start once again with alpha receptor antagonists. These will decrease peripheral vascular resistance because remember, alpha agonists lead to constriction. So blocking that action would lead to dilation. So you're bound to lower PVR and you'll decrease mean blood pressure. And therefore, what you're likely to see? Compensation. How does that compensation come about? By a reflex tachycardia and by humoral mechanisms that will lead to salt and water retention. Now, the tachycardia with alpha blockers depends a lot on whether the alpha blocker is a blocker of both types of alpha receptor or whether it's more selective for alpha-1 receptors. Now, why is this? If a drug blocks alpha-2 receptors, now what do alpha-2 receptors do? These are prejunctional. They're the ones that control norepinephrine release. Well, if you block those receptors, you're not going to stop norepinephrine from being released. And at the level of the heart, the more norepinephrine released, the more you're going to get an increase in heart rate. So drugs that block both types of alpha receptor do cause marked reflex tachycardia, and that limits their clinical applicability, certainly in a chronic fashion. Drugs that are more selective for alpha-1 receptor blocking action cause less reflex tachycardia. Now, I would like you to know the names of two non-selective drugs. They're very old drugs, phentolamine and phenoxybenzamine. How do they differ? Well, phenoxybenzamine is our example of an irreversible antagonist that makes a covalent bond with alpha-1 receptors. Therefore, you can't readily reverse phenoxybenzamine. You could reverse phentolamine because that's a competitive antagonist. But you see, because of the inhibition of the feedback mechanism, they're not going to have very, common clinical uses. They have been used in tumors that produce catecholamines, pheochromocytomas, because they will lower blood pressure. I mean, they're alpha blockers, they'll lower blood pressure. But the reflex effects, the tachycardia, the water retention, tend to be offsetting in terms of their availability for chronic use. If you want to use an alpha blocker chronically, go over to the alpha-1 selective drugs like the Osin family. Prazosin was the first of these drugs, but we have about eight or nine of them now. And you could see if you have eight or nine, since these are all like copycats, me too type drugs, there must be a big interest in that commercially. And there is, because these drugs have been widely used in the management of mild to moderate hypertension. And there are so many millions of us that suffer from hypertension. The big deal about this class of drugs, which, as I say, could be called the Osin family, is that they are selective, but not specific, but they are selective for alpha-1 receptors. So although they will cause a reflex tachycardia, you still have your intact feedback mechanism. So it will not be as bad. All right? It won't be as bad as what we just described for phenoxybenzamine or phentolamine. You will get some degree of postural hypertension, although you actually get tolerant to it. But the first doses of alpha-1 selective blockers have sometimes caused fainting. So that's referred to as first dose syncope. And so you warn your patients about that, especially the elderly patient who is a bit more prone to, changes in terms of vasodilation. Remember, elderly patients tend to be more sensitive to drugs in general, and that goes also for drugs that lower blood pressure. So those particularly you remind that you may get dizzy or you may actually faint with the earlier doses of these drugs. They're used commonly in mild to moderate hypertension, and they also have another clinical use, which is really based on knowing about alpha receptors and what happens in terms of bladder smooth muscle or smooth muscle of the urinary genitory system. In benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is a fancy set of words meaning you've got a big prostate, right? Then the prostate tends to impede urination. You can't go to the bathroom. And if you can actually cause a relaxation of the musculature there, it makes it easier. So alpha-1 selective drugs are quite commonly used in BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is not linked directly in any fashion to prostatic carcinoma, as you probably remind yourself. Okay, what about beta adrenoceptor antagonists? Now, these have multiple actions, and we take advantage of some of these actions clinically, and also have to remind ourselves that the side effects of beta blockers, as we more familiarly call them, can be quite marked. We'll start with the heart. You certainly can decrease contractility because that's a beta 1 response that will also carry with it a decrease in heart rate, cardiac output, and oxygen demand, and should bring down blood pressure because one of the determinants, obviously, of blood pressure is cardiac output. Remember, you know, blood pressure equals cardiac output times, you know, peripheral vascular resistance. And so if you can bring down the cardiac side of things, you can lower blood pressure. That should set you up, I think, for thinking about two clinical uses right off the bat here. I mean, hypertension, sure, we like to bring down blood pressure. Angina, yeah, we like to decrease oxygen demand on the heart muscle. So here you immediately see sort of two clinical uses staring you in the face here. There isn't any orthostatic hypertension because you see, you can't get much of an action of a beta blocker on beta receptors. And the reason for that is that beta receptors in the vasculature are not innervated very well. And antagonist drugs only work where they're getting in the way of an agonist. If the agonist isn't there, what can an antagonist do? Nothing, you know? So antagonists work by stopping the action of an agonist. Well, certainly, we know that norepinephrine's present in the heart, and that certainly seems to be responsible there. But at beta receptors in the vasculature, we don't think that norepinephrine really plays a fundamental role by neural innervation. Certainly, if you have enough of a beta 2 stimulant, you can get vasodilation. But beta blockers don't seem to have much of an effect on vascular tone. Therefore, they will not cause orthostatic hypotension. And that's a very valuable thing in the treatment of blood pressure. Because part of the trouble with using drugs that lower blood pressure is just that, that you might get pooling of the blood. And therefore, when you stand up, you fall down. That's orthostatic hypotension. Okay, however, there is beta blocking action that can be seen, and that may be undesirable. Sometimes you can block AV nodal conduction, which is not a grand idea, and even cause exacerbation of heart failure. Beta activation of the bronchiolar smooth muscle leads to relaxation. Therefore, beta block is likely to lead to constriction. And bronchoconstriction, of course, is, and sometimes bronchospasm, is undesirable. So if you're blocking beta 2 receptors, which are part of the innervation of the bronchiolar smooth muscle, then you may get bronchospasm. And certainly, drugs that block beta 2 receptors are not ideal in the asthmatic patient. You decrease glycogenolysis, and you may mask the symptoms of an overdose of insulin. Overdose of insulin lowers blood sugar. And what do you get when you lower blood sugar? You get both central nervous system dysfunction and sympathetic discharge. Now, how do you express the sympathetic discharge? Well, you have to express that through beta receptors. And if you're blocking beta receptors, how could you see it? So you will not see the increased heart rate that you normally would see in an insulin overdose situation because you can't get an increased heart rate in the presence of a beta blocker. So we refer to it as a masking of the sympathetic signs of insulin overdose or the hypoglycemic situation. Now, one very important clinical use of beta blockers used topically is on the eye. They decrease the activity of the ciliary epithelium. Now, the ciliary epithelium is under the control of beta receptors, and it produces fluid or secretions, which are contributory to the aqueous humor. The aqueous humor, if we increase aqueous humor formation, we increase intraocular pressure, and that, of course, causes the symptoms of glaucoma. Now, if we can decrease those secretions, as we can, by a beta blocker, we'll lead to a decrease in intraocular pressure, and that's a clinical use of beta blockers. The prototype beta blocker is propranolol. Propranolol has been with us for, I think, over 50 years. It is non-selective, works on both beta 1 and beta 2 receptors. Now, I want you to know about a rather unusual effect of many beta blockers, and particularly propranolol. This is a drug that's been used very importantly in the treatment, for example, of hypertension. And it can be used in a chronic fashion there, where it is actually shown to have long-term survival benefit in patients who suffer from hypertension. Interestingly, while you're using the drug in a chronic fashion, there is often a compensatory metabolic change taking place. And it leads to the increase in unfavorable lipids, lipids like low-density lipoprotein cholesterol and triglycerides. And that is a rather fascinating result of giving a drug for hypertension, that actually our bodies actually try to avoid the action of propranolol by making lipids that are associated with atherosclerotic dysfunction or disease. And as you may recall, elevations of LDL and elevations of triglycerides are associated with an increased incidence of atherosclerotic disease, the same as hypertension is associated with an increased incidence of atherosclerotic disease. So here's an anomaly of a drug that's proven to be useful in hypertension, but actually sometimes leads to increases in lipids that are unfavorable. What are you going to do about it? Well, two things. Don't use beta blockers in patients who already have pre-existing dysfunction of the lipid profiles in their blood, and perhaps even use a drug that is less likely to do this, because this is largely a beta 2 type of response. Now, the other thing, while we're on the subject of chronic use of beta blockers, which again was first demonstrated with propranolol, but I think probably relates to most beta blockers, is that our body compensates for the blockade by changing our receptors. We have the phenomenon of receptor upregulation occurring. What does that mean? And it's been shown, by the way, in humans, that it's not just an animal type of study. We've seen it in humans. Chronic use means we get more beta receptors. And that's okay. It may mean that you may need a little bit more of a beta blocker to work, but where the problem occurs is on abrupt discontinuance. You take away the beta blocker, or you, as a patient, may just discontinue it without asking your physician, all right? And what happens? You've got all these new beta receptors there ready to be activated by circulating catecholamines. So here you've been using a beta blocker to lower blood pressure, the drug is stopped, and we get a tremendous increase in activation of beta receptors. And that, particularly in the case of the heart, causes a marked stimulation of the heart, excessive cardiovascular effects, and on occasion has led to cardiac arrhythmias, sudden death, etc. So here's a good example of when a patient's put on a beta blocker, if they're going off it, they have to have the dose tapered, where you gradually lower the dosage of the drug, and that then allows for the upregulation of receptors to be actually brought back into line with the normal situation. It's a dose tapering type of principle. Now, in order to sort out the beta blockers just a little bit more, we have to say something about cardioselectivity. We have a number of beta blockers that work more on beta 1 receptors than on beta 2 receptors. And what I would like you to know is why, and if you can, I'd like you to know what. Now, the why is probably more important than the what, in the sense that the why is because you want to avoid beta 2 effects. You don't want to interfere with beta 2 receptors in all patients. For example, in patients who have peripheral vascular disease, it doesn't make sense to actually use drugs that will actually cause problems of the vasculature. And the vasculature, of course, is a beta 2 receptor. In patients who have asthma, we don't want to actually cause problems with beta 2 receptors in the bronchiolar smooth muscle. Why should we? In patients who have diabetes, for example, not a grand idea to use drugs that work at the level of beta responses. So these types of reasoning, and it's more the reasons perhaps than the individual drugs, make these beta 1 selective drugs safer in asthma, safer in diabetes, and safer in patients who have peripheral vascular diseases. And I'd like you to know the names of a few of them. There are more than this out there, But I like the idea of these three because you can make it into a word that has a little bit of significance from the standpoint of medicine. I mean, the AMA stands for the American Medical Association. And if you knew that, which I'm sure you do, you'd be able to say, well, okay, the first letters in these three drugs that you see here would be remembered if I remember AMA, all right, or AMA. So Acebutolol, Metoprolol, Atenolol are beta-1 selective drugs. So you might like to do it that way. It's not the only beta-1 selective, but it's a good step in that direction. You know, there are more than this, but this is, I think, a good start. We have also another type of beta blocker that actually is thought to work as a partial agonist. Now, what's a partial agonist? A partial agonist is a drug that might, under certain circumstances, work either as an antagonist or as a stimulant of receptors. We've said that, you know, under our considerations of basic principles. Now, here, if a drug has partial agonist activity, it's said to have intrinsic sympathomimetic activity. It's a beta blocker, but it's got a bit of stimulation as well. And the designation for that is ISA. I actually think you might be better off thinking of them as partial agonists because it might help you a little bit. You see, if you have a partial agonist activity, you should get less depression of the heart. So there should be less slowing of heart rate. There should be a minimal change in plasma lipids. And therefore, they would be ideal for patients who have pre-existing hyperlipidemias, because you're not going to make it worse by chronic administration. And the reason I say partial agonist is that the actual two drugs that are most well known as having intrinsic sympathomimetic activity are pindolol and acebutolol. So you can use the term PAR or PA to remind you about the first letters in the names of those two individual drugs. So that may help you a little bit. There may be one or two other drugs out there that are partial agonist or have intrinsic sympathomimetic activity, but I think this is a step that I would take and as far as I would go, actually. Now, what about other things or other properties of beta blockers? You know, there are many, many beta blockers. I'm going to show you a table in the moment, but not ask you to remember everything about it. But there are differences in kinetic properties. Some drugs do not readily cross the blood-brain barrier. That could be good or bad. If you didn't want central nervous system effects, that's certainly a good effect. But certainly some beta blockers are used for central nervous system dysfunction. I'm thinking here largely of what we might call anxiety associated with public performances, that type of thing, where we can decrease the anxiety with certain beta blockers. At least you don't see the sweating and the other sympathetic signs, etc. But it's more than that. There is central nervous system actions as well. And we have differences in half-life. Many of the drugs can be given at once a day basis. Carvedilol and nadolol are examples there. Interestingly, carvedilol is an example of a drug that is not a single drug anyway, and it has properties of both alpha and beta block. And likewise, the drug labetalol, and both of these should be known to you, because you'll see why when we get to the applications in cardiovascular pharmacology, both labetalol and carvedilol have alpha-blocking activity, although they're nominally classified as beta blockers. Interestingly, most beta blockers you can identify by the end of the word being olol, O-L-O-L. But you'll notice that these two drugs happen to be exceptions to the rule, carvedilol and labetalol. It was called labetalol to actually designate that it had alpha blocking action as well as beta blocking action. Here's our table, and I don't think I need to go through it formally with you, but I just want to point out to you which drugs are beta-1 selective, which drugs are thought to have intrinsic sympathomimetic or partial agonist activity, which cross the blood-brain barrier and may have sedating properties, And notice that not all beta blockers increase plasma lipids, and for that reason, there may be choices made here on the basis of particular patient set of circumstances. It really depends, you know, on comorbid conditions. I mean, the most obvious one would be, you know, if you have hyperlipidemia, why would you want to use a beta blocker that would encourage an increase in plasma lipids? I think you get the idea there. You might like to sort of glance under propranolol at the widespread clinical uses there of propranolol. It is our most famous beta blocker, has tremendous widespread use in the cardiovascular arena, but is also a type of drug used in migraine, for essential tremor, for performance anxiety. And of course, beta blockers would oppose excessive thyroid hormone actions on the heart. And that's another property that you might think of in the context of beta blockers. So they have quite a widespread set of clinical uses, as you can see.